Today is a great day. It's a beautiful weather outside, and it's nice to be inside here with all our friends. And I'm glad to see so many of you here. I am privileged to be able to introduce our speaker today. Justice Shay Nichols serves on the Kentucky Supreme Court. Prior to that, he served 13 years on the Court of Appeals and 3 years on the Supreme Court. He is a native of McCracken County, graduate of Paducah Tillman High School. He received his B.S. degree from DePaul University and his law degree from the University of Kentucky. Justice Nichols believes in service above self. He is a member of the Paducah Lions Club. He serves as the international director for Lions Club International, whose membership includes 45,000 clubs. He has been named to the Kentucky Lions Club Hall of Fame. He is a former Eagle Scout and serves on the board of Paducah Market House Museum. He is a 32nd degree Mason and serves as a deacon and song leader at Paducah's Heartland Church. He is well known as a historian and has recently appeared on KETV talking about Alvin Barkley and the history that surrounds his term in Congress, in Senate, and in White House. Today you're going to get a short version of that KETV program. And he has also brought a memorabilia, which is located at the back table. And after the program today, he will be able to let you look at it and he can explain it. And he's got one thing that I hope he talks about is the gold watch up here. And we're delighted to hear. So would you give a big warm rotary welcome to Shay Nichols.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Hang tight, Chaplain. Well, to begin with, the judge here was mentioning one special item I brought with you, and this is my pride and joy. This I'm going to pass around because I think history needs to be touched and felt, and it should be alive for everybody. But this is the gold watch that the McCracken Fiscal Court presented to Alvin Barkley when he was a young fella, just elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, as a gift to him as he went up to Washington. And over there in the back table, there's a picture of a young buck standing outside the White House. That was the first picture he took in Washington, D.C., because he aimed to live there one day. Didn't quite make it to live there, but he had very many meetings there. But this gold watch, if you look on the inside, has inscriptions there from all of the officials there from McCracken County. And it's literally a history of the county when you look up all those names and what they did during their lifetime. So I'm going to let the judge here hold that and then just pass it around, and I trust everybody here to get it back to me, all right? Figure that with this many judges here, we're okay.
Big trouble.
Judge, start there with Bill Cunningham. There you go. No one better to start with than dear old Bill. Well, my topic today concerns the late, great Kentucky statesman, Vice President Alvin W. Barkley, a name well known, though not the history or the legacy of the person to whom it is attached. In fact, I've served on a number of boards, particularly museum boards, and regrettably, many times when we have young people come in from the elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, we mentioned Barkley, they get that deer in the headlights look, and they don't really know who he was or why he would have so many things named for him. So I think we need to do a better job in teaching our history to our young people. So we're going to be short on time today. There's a lot of things that I could cover. I'm going to try to talk fast. And not chase too many rabbits, because everything I tell you today will probably have 20, 30 stories behind it that I could share with you. But just in the time we have today, I hope to give you a flavor of the great gentleman to whom the name Alvin W. Barkley was attached. Certainly want to start today by thanking Judge Chappell Wilson for the kind invitation for me to come and be with you today. I've been here before, and I always know it's going to be a warm welcome, great food, and terrific fellowship. So thank you, Chappell, for having me back. Also want to recognize all the dignitaries here, but particularly my good friend Justice Cunningham. Justice Cunningham has had many wise sayings and proverbs and so forth attached to him. And one thing that I remember Justice Cunningham having said is, you never know who you've met when you meet a child. You remember that, Bill? You've said that many times in my presence. And that's so true. And so today, as I begin, my mind goes back to President Kennedy. And he was at a boys' state event in Washington, D.C., and a young whippersnapper walked up and thrust out his hand to him, and they shook hands. Photographer was there and took that picture. You know which one I'm talking about. And, of course, that was young Willie Clinton, Bill Clinton, who shook President Kennedy's hand there on the White House lawn. And lo and behold, years later, he would rise to serve in the same position. But Bill, do you remember that photograph that you showed me from, I believe it was, where was it? Was it with Barkley? Yeah. Justice Cunningham showed me a picture, sent it to me one late night, said, do you know this gentleman in this picture? And I looked at it, and I said, well, sure, Bill, that's Vice President Alvin Barkley. And he said, yeah, he was coming through town, and he was giving his last speech before he went back home to see how the election went. And some of you in here know about election nights and how that can be. But he said, you know, notice anything else about that picture? And I said, well, no, Bill, a lot of people there. I'd expect that. But there was a whole row of young boys sitting behind the Veep and taking in what he was saying. He said, do you recognize any of those boys? And I said, no, sir. And he said, well, take a look at that one with the hair sticking up right in the middle there. He said, that's me. So similar situation. The hands of history being passed from one great statesman to another. And we thank you for your service, Justice Cunningham, and all that you mean to this community. So let me just dive in. I'm going to try to move as quick as I can to cover as much as I can. But Barkley was one of four vice presidents from Kentucky. And I know you all know all this, but let me refresh your memory. The first one was Richard Johnson. He was from Jefferson County, born in 1780. And he served as the ninth vice president under President Martin Van Buren. He graduated from Transylvania University in Lexington. And due to some financial problems and unpopularity and lack of any meaningful vice presidential role, he abandoned his duties in Washington, D.C., and returned to Kentucky to open up a tavern. He was considered somewhat of a vulgar man, to quote President Van Buren, who thought so highly of him that he abandoned him as a running mate for the second term, considering it better to have no running mate at all. Then the second vice president Kentucky had was John C. Breckinridge out of Fayette County, born 1821. He was the 14th vice president, served under President James Buchanan, graduate of Center College in Danville. He's the only vice president to ever take up arms against the United States and thereby gave up a bright future as perchance a future president of our nation. Then there, of course, is Adlai Stevenson, the first. Well, wait a minute. Adlai Stevenson, he was the governor of Illinois and went on to the UN ambassador. And are you talking about that fellow from up north, that Yankee? No. You folks from down Hopkinsville know exactly what I'm talking about. The Barclays and the Stevensons hailed from over in your neck of the wood. So Adlai Stevenson III, he did move off to Illinois and became governor there. He was the second Democratic candidate for U.S. a two-time Democratic candidate for U.S. President, U.S. Secretary to the United Nations and all that. That's the third. That's Adlai Stevenson the third. But his grandfather was vice president and was from down here outside of Hopkinsville. And the Stevensons, by the way, are distant cousins to the Barclays. And in fact, Barclay's maternal grandmother would often hold up his famous relatives as a role model and someone that he could live up to and aspire to reach the same heights. And then, of course, there was Barclay. So the evidence of Barclay's greatness and impact are all around us. Anybody ever hear of Barclay Lake or Barclay Lodge?
Never heard of it.
No. Well, and Barclay Airport, Barclay Drive, Barclay Museum. If you go down to Emory University, they have a distinguished chair for named for Barclay and their speech department, their debate department. It's the Barclay Society. A lot of infrastructure and programs evidencing his influence. USEC here in our region, the WPA and CCC programs, which built parks and so many facilities around our area. TVA, Fort Campbell, not a very far distance from here. Y'all realize that Fort Campbell does have a Kentucky zip code, right? Did you also know that two-thirds of the camp is in Tennessee? Wonder how that came about. I think Barclay had a hand in that, as well with Fort Knox and a number of other places. If you go down to Fort Campbell, by the way, Colonel, they have an elementary school there by the name of Barclay Elementary, which I've been invited down a couple of times to speak to the young people about. So he had historical importance that was heralded in many books. I brought some of the books with me back there on the back table, magazine articles. His opinions were highly sought after because he was known as a wise person, not only in the area of law, but also in economics, which he had studied a great deal. He was a strong and early proponent of civil rights, which often placed him at odds with many members of his own party, particularly the Southern senators. In fact, one time there was an anti-lynching bill that was supposed to come to the floor of the Senate to be voted on, and they all vanished so that it couldn't be voted on. And Barclay warmed himself to their hearts by having them all arrested and brought back to the Senate chambers and forced them to vote. Some of them never spoke to him again, but he was a strong leader and firm when he had to be, just like many of the judges and justices gathered here today. But he pushed the anti-lynching bills and desegregation of the military. He was a strong proponent of the establishment of Israel, due in large part to the influence of his friend, associate U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, whose nomination by President Wilson in 1916 Barclay had supported. He was a strong proponent of the establishment of the United Nations following World War II. That should come as no surprise because he was a strong proponent of President Wilson's plan for the League of Nations years earlier. He was recognized early for his knowledge of law and economics, like I had shared with you, and for his leadership skills, which were characterized by a strong but humorous consensus-building hand. He coined many well-known phrases, including the title Veep, which, by the way, came from his grandson, who had trouble pronouncing his eminence, United States Vice President of the United States and so forth. He said, "Paps, can we just reduce that just to the V and the P and maybe just call you Veep?" And Barclay shared that with the media. And then the name caught on, and of course now we refer to all of our vice presidents as the Veep. He also saw Truman off at the train station as they started their whistle stop campaign in 48. And as Harry was pulling out of the station, he said, "Give them hell, Harry." Did you ever hear that? Well, that's where it came from Barclay. So much for the ones that would say, I'm just mild about Harry. They were shown up a little bit later in the election. But he was known for using stories and anecdotes to make a point, to reduce stress, and to bring people back together. One of the stories that he shared was, I refer to it as, "What have you done for me lately?" And some of you public officials in here know what I'm talking about. You might have done 10 or 15 things for some family, and then you hear that they're supporting your opponent in the next election, and you ask them about it, and they said, "Well, yeah, you did all those things for me, but what have you done for me lately?" And Barclay would tell that story and get a smile or a laugh. He would also talk about his frustration of not getting some of his colleagues to join in on some of the important programs and projects of the day. And he would tell the story of the fisherman that would go out here in the middle of the lake, and his boat would spring a leak with his buddy up front just bailing away. And finally, as they were about to go under and be drowned, his buddy looked back and said, "Why haven't you helped out?" And he said, "Well, wait a minute, you don't understand. This ain't my boat." You know, so anyway, he had a good sense of humor that he would use to get things done. Over the course of his 51-year career in public service, he served 14 years in the U.S. House, 23 years in the U.S. Senate, where he championed many, many programs. He had a heavy hand in supporting Woodrow Wilson's New Freedom programs. He was an architect of the New Deal programs of President Franklin Roosevelt. And, of course, he was Senate Majority Leader and Minority Leader and then Vice President with Harry Truman in getting the Fair Deal programs passed. Over the course of his life, Barclay's leadership and abilities brought him many recognitions. He was considered as a leading vice presidential nominee over the years by Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, several times, but he was needed in the Senate to use his legislative skills to get bills passed, so he was passed over. Likewise, a lot of people don't know this, but in addition to wanting perhaps to serve as U.S. president one day, he also had his sights set on the U.S. Supreme Court. But there again, he was passed over many times as those seats became available because President Roosevelt needed him in the Senate to help get through the legislation over there. But being a good Kentuckian, Barclay made sure that through his influence and leadership, four other Kentuckians were appointed to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court during his tenure, including his good friend, U.S. Chief Justice Fred Vinson from Louisa, Kentucky, who just happened to have served as Barclay's campaign chairman when he first ran for the Senate. Funny how those things work out. Barclay received the Congressional Gold Medal. In 1952, Look magazine indicated that Barclay and General Dwight Eisenhower were America's two most popular and respected leaders. The University of Wisconsin named Barclay among the top 10 orators of the past century. And in fact, he served as Democratic keynoter three times and placed President Roosevelt's name in nomination in 1932. He delivered one of the greatest political speeches of all time in 1948 at the Democratic Convention, whereby he secured the nomination as vice president and reviving the party. They went on to victory. And by the way, U.S. Justice Douglas, he turned down the opportunity to run with Truman because he didn't want to be a part of any losing team. So Barclay showed him how to be a winner. Barclay also was known nationally and internationally as a great speaker, to have come to speak at any event. Because of his wife's illness, he gave speeches across the country. They didn't have enough money to pay for her medical expenses otherwise on the salary that he made as a senator. And upon her death, he contributed $10,000, a good sum for the day, that he had won from Collier's Public, as Collier's Magazine's Public Servant of the Year, and he gave that to the University of Louisville Medical School. So Barclay's life and legacy. While he was born in a little crossroads by the name of Wheel down near Lowe's, Kentucky, right between Lowe's and Fancy Farm, back in November 24 of 1877. And his life was shaped by his youthful experiences. For instance, his sibling responsibility. He was the eldest of eight children born to John Wilson Barclay and his wife Electa Eliza Smith Barclay. He was born into poverty. His parents were tenant farmers. They moved about quite a bit. He was birthed in a rented log house of his paternal grandparents, and his paternal grandmother was the midwife at his birth. He recalled in his older days as a public servant the flooding that hit our area so often, which caused him to have programs put in place to prevent flooding with the dams and so forth. Talked about walking across the frosted fields without shoes and trying to walk in the footprints of other kids that walked ahead of him so his feet didn't get cold until the harvest came in and his parents could afford shoes for the children. He worked besides many minorities in the fields, and he recalled their wonderful music and their wisdom that they shared with him as he worked beside them as a young boy. And then later in life, he was a champion of civil rights. His religious upbringing, Presbyterian. His father was an elder in the church. His mother died a member of the Highland Cumberland Presbyterian Church over in Paducah. Highland Cumberland Presbyterian Church. His parents emphasized education, hard work. They were anti-alcohol, anti-gambling. His heritage, Scotch-Irish, like many of us here. His family had come over from Scotland and Ireland, fought in the Revolutionary War, and like many families represented here today, were given land grants to come out here to this area and settle, including my own family. If you've heard of Nickel Branch over in between the rivers, that's... That was some of my family that followed the same course to get over here. So he also, the education, he attended the rural public schools there in the Lowe's community, and then he headed over to Marvin College, where he attended school in Clinton. He excelled there in speech and debate, as well as sports, to the point that his teachers all encouraged him to pursue further education, and many of them had gone to Emory down in Georgia, Emory College, which was located at Oxford at the time. It's now Emory University in Atlanta, but he set his sights on going down there. He couldn't afford to go, so he set about selling pots and pans around all the farming families in his community. And made a significant amount of money. He was a great salesperson. But then he started hearing back from the wives of those farmers, and those pots that he had sold them were all cracking once they put them in the fire. So he had a moral decision to make, and he made the right choice. He returned every cent that he had taken from those families, bore the brunt of that financial hardship himself. And fortunately, a local district judge heard of his plight and was so impressed by how he had handled the situation that he gave him the money to go off to college, for at least for the first year. And during that year, he joined the debate society, Delta Tau Delta fraternity, and was very popular there. But his money ran out after the 1 year, and he returned to Marvin College, where he had a very brief tenure as a teacher. Apparently, he wasn't that much older than the other students, and he couldn't make them behave. I think he was just as mischievous as they were, actually. So he then decided, well, I'm going to go ahead and pursue my dream and become a lawyer. And someone that he knew through college knew Congressman Charles Wheeler. Wrote a letter to Congressman Wheeler, and Wheeler took him on as a law clerk. Only thing was, Wheeler thought it was such a great honor to work for the congressman that he didn't think he needed to pay him. So in those days, you could earn a law degree by reading for the law as you worked in the law office. And so Barclay said about that. But it wasn't long before he looked down the street and found a new employer, a former congressman by the name of John Kerr Hendrick out of Livingston County, hired him. He would later run against him, by the way, for another office. But he became he studied the law there. And while there, the secretary of the law firm took pity on him because she knew his financial plight. She taught him stenography, how to take a testimony down. And so he then got on, hired on over at the circuit court's office to take down testimony from lawsuits going on over there. It served him well when he was first elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. You see, he was hired the same year that Woodrow Wilson was elected president. Of course, you know that Woodrow Wilson had been president of, Princeton, wasn't it? And so, you know, when you're a new freshman congressman, they take you over to the courthouse, to the White House, and they let you have your 5 minutes of conversation with the president. So while Barclay was chatting with the newly elected president, Wilson, Wilson asked, well, how'd you get here, son? And he mentioned the fact that he had made his way there partially by being a stenographer. And President Wilson said, do say. He said, well, what type of stenography do you utilize? And lo and behold, they actually had a discussion, lengthy discussion then, about their particular style of stenography. And Wilson took such a liking to him that he became a mentor and a friend and made sure that Barclay was appointed to some of the most influential committees in the House, which opened the door then for his future. So he wore many hats, farmer, student, orator, teacher, law clerk, stenographer, lay speaker, civic club leader, county official, politician, public servant, and the like. So about his family, how are we doing? He was married. He met a gal when he came back over to Paducah to practice. He met a lady by the name of Dorothy Barclay. They were married and had 3 children. They were doting parents, took them all over the country to teach them history. And she was the consummate political wife, campaigner, social hostess, and traveling companion. They attended Broadway United Methodist Church, where he was a very active lay leader in the church and a popular speaker. Unfortunately, Dorothy died in 1947 before he became vice president, just 1 year before, after battling an illness, which for 5 years kept her at their home there in Paducah. So Barclay then met his second wife at a gathering in Washington, D.C. Interestingly, she was about 30 years his junior. And she was also Republican at the time. She, as he would say, she came to see the light and changed over. But she was known to have left a note outside her door one time when she found out that her milkman was a Democrat. The note said, no Wilkie, no Milky. Anyway, she was... they had a wonderful marriage. She had 2 daughters, so he had 2 stepdaughters. And a few years ago, a friend of mine had connected with one of those daughters down in Virginia, and I had a wonderful conversation with her about her childhood in Paducah. So I know we're getting short on time, so I'm going to move ahead here. I've talked about him being a Paducah lawyer. He then became McCracken County attorney. And during his tenure as a county attorney, he actually prosecuted some of his fellow Democrats. Can go figure that they got a little corrupt. And they were so corrupt that the next election, all the Democrats lost except one. Guess which one? One, Barclay, because he had stood up and said, no, we're going to do things right. Then he moved on to become a McCracken County judge, was elected to the House of Representatives, I've told you the story about how serendipitously he had come to know Wilson and fallen under Wilson's influence. So he wore his political life as a badge of honor. He repudiated the former hands-off approach of government. He believed that government should not be static, but it should be responsive to the needs of the people. As he put it, government should not be a tired old mule tied to a fixed and rotting hitching post, but a strong and stout workhorse properly harnessed to pull heavily loaded wagons or engaged in plowing new fields in the service of its people. So he did run. He did lose one election. He ran unsuccessfully for governor of Kentucky in 1923, his only loss. He ran as a progressive Democrat. He lost to a conservative Democrat. But he ran on a progressive program that put forth, among other things, anti-alcohol. Now, you might think that that's kind of a flip, but it demonstrates how some issues can flip from being considered progressive in one era and conservative in another, because the liberals, the progressives, put forth the prohibition as a social mechanism for dealing with children that were left abused and wives left alone and so forth. They didn't foresee the terrible evils that came from prohibition, so they flipped over and in fact, it was Barclay that announced in 1932 that they were going to the Democratic Party was going to go the other direction. So some people think that he actually ran for governor as preparation to run for other offices to meet the other political leaders around the state. But his campaign style earned him the nickname of Iron Man. He just seemed to have full energy. During the 48 campaign, while Truman was doing the whistle stop on trains, Barclay was doing what he called the prop stop because he liked airplanes. And so he that's how he campaigned during the 48 campaign. He became Senate Majority Leader by one vote. FDR had heard that Barclay might be in favor of his court packing plans, and so he wrote a letter to Dear Albin and let it be released that he thought he might do a good job, and so Barclay won by one vote and became one of Roosevelt's big four congressional leaders. He would often meet in conference with the president over at the White House. So, though Democrats controlled both chambers of Congress, they were seriously divided between progressive and liberal wings, particularly the Southern conservative, the Dixiecrats, somewhat similar to what we have today, isn't it, with the Republican Party being somewhat divided, even though they have a majority. But Barclay would use his charm, and when the charm didn't work, he would use the rules to get legislation through. Happy Chandler, remember Happy Chandler, governor, very popular governor of Kentucky, decided he'd take old Barclay on during some of his travails as Senate Majority Leader, and it was a bitterly fought race. It's alleged that Happy Chandler used the state workers to help his campaign, and it's alleged that Barclay might have used the federal workers to help him out. But what came of that election was the Hatch Act, which everyone has to abide by now. That's where that emanated. But there's a famous photograph up in Covington, Kentucky, of Happy Chandler having jumped in a car between Roosevelt, who had come to Kentucky to campaign for Barclay, and Barclay. And so you have Roosevelt on one side of the car thinking, you know, what in the devil is going on here? And you've got Barclay on the other side, madder than a hornet, obviously, and you have Happy Chandler right in the middle just grinning like, you know, like the world was at his feet. But they had a lot of fun in their campaigning in those days, too. But during the World War II, Barclay supported the Lend-Lease Bill that led up, leading up to the war, the Pearl Harbor investigation. After the war, he led that committee and he also led the committee that investigated the war crimes investigation, our matters over there. He did finally, though, split with Roosevelt over the tax bill. President Roosevelt wanted a lot more money than Barclay and other senators and leaders felt like the people could handle. And so Barclay went against the president, and the president came out with a nasty speech that Barclay took offense to, felt like the president was attacking the legislative branch. And so he just went to the Senate floor and, after giving a speech about the president, resigned. His Democratic Party colleagues, they immediately, the next morning, reelected him as Senate Majority Leader, which put egg on the president's face somewhat. And so when President Roosevelt was coming up for his next run for office, he passed over Barclay, who was pretty well considered the choice, and went with a guy from Missouri by the name of Harry Truman. And then Roosevelt died a short time after, and you all know what happened. Well, the politics changed over a little bit. Barclay became Senate Minority Leader, and then became an aide to Truman and ultimately his vice president. I know we're about out of time here, so I just will close with this story to you. Barclay left politics, 52. He ran for president, was abandoned by the unions, and so he just dropped out, went home, wrote his autobiography, started farming again. His good friend Sam Rayburn asked him to come back and run against John Sherman Cooper to flip the Senate back over so that a young fellow by the name of Lyndon Johnson could become the Senate Majority Leader. And of course, we know he became president then. So Barclay did that, ran against his old friend John Sherman Cooper. But he didn't have the power anymore that he had had in the early days. And so he was going around giving speeches, and he went to Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia. They were having a mock convention there, and they asked the old war horse to come back and give one of his Rip Snorton speeches. And he was right in the midst of it. And he came to the place where he paraphrased the book of Psalm, and he said, "For I would rather be a servant in the house of the Lord than to sit in the seats of the mighty." He was talking about when he came back to the Senate, his buddies said, "Come on up here, sit up front with the rest of us after all you've done." And he said, "No, I'm going to sit on the back row with the rest of the freshman senators back there with Hubert Humphrey, Kennedy, and so many others that he mentored on the back row." But that's what he was talking about when he said, "I'd rather be a servant in the house of the Lord than sit in the seats of the mighty." And at that very instant, he had a heart attack, fell over, and died. I do hope that when I am elevated into the next life, that my words will be as eloquent as Barclay's and not, "Oh no," or something much worse. But anyway, with that, I thank you for having me back. Thank you for your time. If any of you'd like to stay around and look at some of the memorabilia that I brought with me, every piece back there has a story to it. But again, thank you. Most important thing I can say today is thank you for your service to your community, for giving back to the next generation, being mentors and friends. And there's no higher calling than to be a servant. Thank you so much.